And so the title of this talk is The Ecology of Compassion, the interrelationship between our inner world and our outer world. It's said that after the Buddha's enlightenment under the great Bodhi tree almost 2,600 years ago in India, he profoundly opened to understand and realize the truth of suffering, the cause of suffering, the cessation of all suffering, and he held the knowledge of how to develop what leads to the end of suffering, what he called the Eightfold Noble Path, the advancement of the holy life to ceasing, to stilling, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. It's said that even with this rare and precious understanding that the Buddha had, he was reluctant to offer it to others. And I found that hard to believe, that he was reluctant to offer it to others, because he thought if listeners would just listen to it and kind of take it in intellectually, and they would not practice it, they would be stuck in conceptualizations about the Four Noble Truths and would misunderstand what he really said, and that people really needed to practice to actually apply coming to a sense of stillness in the body and the mind and see what's going on really deep levels. So not just to understand the Four Noble Truths theoretically, but to understand them in practice. And the first of the Noble Truths is opening to suffering, opening to the truth of suffering. So he was influenced by opening to that truth of suffering in himself and in the world. And he was reminded by actually a celestial being that there are beings in the world but with little dust in their eyes. And they would be able to take in and to apply the training. And also from that application of actually doing the practice, they would be able to understand experientially and benefit from what the Buddha taught, from what the Buddha understood. So it's said that in the opening to that, to the suffering of his own heart and how that tormented his own mind, seeing that and seeing and looking out into the world and understanding that there are beings, what that happens to all the time, and opening to the suffering in the world, it was a strong and natural inclination of his heart to help, to incline his mind towards helping others to relieve themselves from this kind of misunderstanding, this wrong view, this suffering. So it was because of compassion that actually he decided to offer to other beings, to offer this teaching to other beings. It's said that the proximate cause for compassion to arise is opening to suffering. And it's not opening to suffering in a way that kind of weakens us or causes us to push it away, but it's in that particular way of opening with compassion to suffering. And so from that he decided to teach. So we can say that these precious teachings that are being offered to us since that time and that we're all benefiting from today are coming to us from this blessed energy of great compassion. And it's sort of the wave that the Dharma is riding on through all this time and space. So yesterday or last night, maybe some of you were here, I had come across some time ago an old journal. And in it, I found a passage where I was describing what I was going through during that time. And I was, say, in my early 20s then. And I mentioned there a little phrase called a sense of a quiet desperation about life. A quiet desperation about life. And I wanted to understand, what was that? I mean, I would have this quiet desperation even when things were sort of in the okay range in my life. And I still had this deep kind of agitation in the mind that wanted to understand what life was all about. It was kind of pushing me to understand more deeply. And Manindra translated that, my teacher at that time, Manindraji, translated that as a spiritual urgency. What we call in the Pali language, that ancient language that the Buddha's teachings were handed down in, we call that samvega, spiritual urgency. And there was this deep inner push or pull or both to understand what this life is all about and how can we come to a place of deep peace with whatever is going on. So I wanted to understand life in a liberating way, in a really totally liberating way, not just to make my life more comfortable, but to realize more deeply than that. So I asked him at the time, what is the meaning of my life? What is the reason for my being a human being? And he very clearly answered without any hesitation at all, it is to develop compassion and wisdom, those two qualities, and to use both of those in my own life to bring that that understanding to what's happening in my own heart, to free my own heart, and then to, if I can, when I can, I would help others also. So in some Buddhist traditions, these qualities, wisdom and compassion, are known as the two great wings of the Dharma, the two great wings of the Dharma. And if we don't really have them in balance in our life, then we can't really let that bird fly to freedom. It can't do that when there isn't a balance of those two. In our kind of colloquial way, we can say that our lives are not really integrated with both the love and compassion side and the wisdom and clarity side. That both of those have to be interwoven and actually used in our life from the heart and not just kind of talking about it. So this is what we're opening to here. We're opening to that really deep nature of the Dhamma in Buddhist terms also. The Dhamma means the truth of how it is. It's not the truth, although we find the truth and we find ease and some kind of unraveling or deeper understanding in our minds when we understand the truth of life psychologically, scientifically, in all kinds of ways like that. I find those areas to be really helpful for me because it actually helps me get closer to nature in here, in this mind and heart and body. So what we're opening to is the deepest truths of life, the truths that are beyond a sense of self, are beyond a sense of that we think all things should be permanent and perfect, and to be able to live our lives in alignment with what the deepest truth is, but at the same time be able to live with compassion about our suffering around that. So we're opening here to nature, to really true nature. You know, when we hear all these ways of saying, we're opening to our true nature. And it sounds really good, but you know, I don't know about you, but for a long time I didn't know what that really meant. It sounded pretty good. But it, you know, came time to really live it and not just say it. So here we have these rare conditions and this beautiful place that we all can come to and have support and structure so that we can look inside, we can see what's happening in here in this quiet environment and perhaps see more clearly and then bring that out into the world, what we learn about ourselves, which is, you know, similar to what everybody else is going through, and see if we can connect our understanding of ourselves in trying to understand how others may be or feel, or why there's this kind of chaos in the world. So we open to what's going on beneath the outer layer of busyness in our lives. We open with courage. We need the courage to do that. And so, of course, there are many beautiful experiences, and that's what keeps drawing us back to the Dharma. You know, when we can have that really connect, that deep connection with peace, and that kind of, where we're not fighting life, or we're not hanging on to it, but we can just feel at ease with whatever's happening. And maybe feel at ease without any defilements, you know, bothering the mind, the body, the heart. And so we come back again and again. And again and again we come back to opening to the vulnerability that we are as human beings. And that's hard, you know. We're always kind of looking for something else in a way. But if we can come to the Dharma intentionally to open to the vulnerability, we would actually have an easier time because that's our intention. Sometimes, for example, I'll have a difficult time in my practice. And there are times like that, even for very seasoned meditators like many of you are, having difficulty opening to difficult places inside oneself. And so I'll notice, like, after, it might take even a few sittings and walkings when I'm in retreat or in my daily life to notice, well, I'm really struggling about something. And it could be a long time that I'm struggling with something. And then I realize that I need to make the intention to actually open to the struggle. And I forget about that. It's so obvious that I forget about that. So when I actually make the intention, okay, and the next time I'm sitting or walking or washing the dishes or whatever I'm doing, and that inner struggle comes up in me, or that kind of fight with life, or wanting it to be different than the way it is, instead of just kind of handling it then and there and just having the habit pattern of going through the same old motions, I'll remember that next time this comes up, may the heart and mind be open to what's going on with compassion, with wisdom, whatever is needed. Sometimes there needs to be a little more kind of clarity, kind of like a Dhamma objectivity. Okay, this is what's going on right now, the wisdom part of it. It's painful in the heart. And sometimes it needs more softening. It needs more gentleness. It needs more really going close and saying, okay, I can be friends with you, more friendliness. So to go into those moments with intentionality. Because then we can really open to the fact of how vulnerable we are as a human being. For one thing, what we see when we sit is that there's constant change. And sometimes we sit down in this constant change, like all the thinking that goes on. And it's so natural. I mean, we have a heart that beats and pumps, and we have a liver that detoxifies and does all the other things I don't even know about. And we actually have a mind that thinks. And when we think we shouldn't be thinking, I mean, this is totally wrong view, because the mind will think. And of course, what we're learning here, and the mind has emotions and it has mental states, and a lot of them come by habit patterns because we don't even know what to do with them. We just act them out. And so they're reinforced by karma. But when we can actually open to the fact that, oh, thinking is natural. Somebody just gave that example to me today about understanding that this is the nature. This is how it is. And the whole sense of needing to kind of apply or surround it with or solidify with it a sense of self was able to drop away and to just be able to notice and have thinking happen and have awareness happen, but also have the stability in the awareness and not in the thinking. because thinking comes and goes. So does awareness. But there can be a continuity, a consistency of awareness always arising with what's happening, always disappearing and arising with another awareness with what's happening. And there can be that constancy, that consistency of awareness arising and passing away as well. But what happens to the objects is that they're always changing. So thinking and all of its different forms come, the mental states that come along with it, we're happy, we're sad, we're angry. If we can see that in its fluidity and its changing nature, we get used to that vulnerability. We get used to being vulnerable in that way. And it becomes natural to be vulnerable in that way, to see the constant change in our minds and how it just goes up and down and it's very fickle. And so when this, and this part is really important, that when the mind is more stabilized in the constancy of awareness, it's not getting so lost in what this awareness is aware of. And so it isn't getting so attached to or identified with it. We have to be careful not to identify with awareness either, but that's a different story. So this part about not being so caught in the object is really important, because we tend to wrap a sense of self around what awareness is actually being, is seeing, is mirroring, is reflecting. So we become more used to the vulnerability of constant change. And so it's not about, you know, seeing that it's this time now and later it gets dark or whatever, the weather patterns or the seasons, or that people are born, they live and they die. Even that kind of change it gets used to. I mean, that's kind of more serious, and being able to face birth and life and death and the whole process of that. But to be able to face kind of really, really hard things that we might have an Achilles heel about, kind of that really soft, most vulnerable place in our hearts where we might sometimes feel abandoned, or that maybe life changes so much that all of a sudden we had something like a really great job and then we lost it. And along with that comes all kinds of survival issues about money and about how we're going to support our families and things like that. So we become more used to this constant change. And when change like that happens, we're able to face it better in the world. But we're also able to see on a deep level, on that very deep wisdom level, the constant coming and going, the fluctuation of the mind, the fluctuation of the body. And we start holding on, stop holding on to that, that it needs to be a certain way. So there's more ease around it. There's more wisdom, and then there's more ease around it. And then that's a constant change that goes on around us. And then there's a change that goes on within us, the mind states that I was just talking about, in relationship to what goes on out there. And that's what I call the reactivity to life. We can have reactivity to what's going on out there, to the changes that go on in the world, environmental, political, agricultural, things that are happening in our forests today that are really not good. But they are what they are. Doesn't mean we don't face it, we don't do something about it. It's just that if we're in reactivity to it, if we're like, I don't like this, it's wrong, all these people are doing it wrong, and maybe I'm one of them too, and aversion and attachment to how we think it should be, we really can't see clearly then. We really can't find a way then to respond to life in a way that's going to be beneficial, which is kind of letting the old habit patterns play out. And so when there is reactivity inside, when we see that there's that vulnerability also that way, Can we bring compassion to that moment of seeing the fear that normally comes up when certain conditions arise in our lives, and the ways that we kind of fight life? We don't want it to be a certain way, of course, but that's natural also for us not to like pain or not to want pain. But there's a way which we can lessen that reactivity by bringing some softness to that moment. And I will use an equanimity phrase, but it also has a very soft way of saying that is, this is the way it is right now. And it's not like a harsh thing, like, hey Kamala, this is the way it is, and if you don't face it, then you're really going to be lost in life. But it's more like saying, Kamala, this is the way it is right now. And it brings that compassion tone into it. So sometimes you bring that compassion to yourself in the way you speak with yourself, and can you soften that? Can you speak with oneself in maybe using softer language, or maybe using a tone in your heart that has a tone of compassion to it? Because we're born into this world of great vulnerability, and there's a lot that we can do about it outwardly in the outer world and in the inner world when we can have that sense of gentleness towards ourselves and towards the world. And it's not like we're being stepped on. We're allowing ourselves to be stepped on. But it's about not allowing ourselves to get lost in the aversion, the attachment, the delusion, the ignorance, the ignoring what's going on. Because conditions at every level are constantly in flux. They're constantly changing. Situations around us, I mentioned yesterday, militarily, agriculturally, economically, politically, and all of this is affecting each other as well. So everything's just constantly in this flux. And it's not just now, it's not just in this world cycle that it's been like that perennially, but it's been in constant world cycles in this layer of existence, in this samsara. It doesn't mean that we give up doing anything about it. We must do something about whatever we can. We must give our help in the world. But it's also facing kind of like the bigness of it all, and also the depth of it all, seeing the depth and seeing the how it spans out into the world. The environment, the elements of earth, air, fire, water, endlessly interacting with one another. And, you know, a lot of it can be sort of humanly driven, and a lot of it, it's just the evolution of this earth as a planet. So there's floods and droughts and beautiful weather patterns and disastrous ones too. And it is all part of life. I mean, I'm not perfect at doing this. And so when I put these words down on paper, it's like I need to understand this too more deeply. I'm learning all the time from the Dharma talks. I'm talking to myself as well. So we open to the vulnerability of our bodies too. It's not just this body of Mother Earth, but it's this body affecting us. Aging, illness, what and how we eat, the environment, the natural environment, and also the toxins in the environment. On a cellular level, our bodies also affected by our minds. They're finding this out too, that the body is affected by what we think. You know, just if you think a thought that's fearful and it, our body goes like that, we might feel it first in the body because the body's more gross, the mind is more ephemeral, but even the thoughts Our own thoughts affect us. People's thoughts around us and emotions around us and our own emotions affect our, on a cellular level, they're finding this in scientific research, also affects us on a cellular level. It also can change us on very, very deep levels. So we're affected by this vulnerability in so many ways, outwardly, inwardly, and the mind. We see here the habit patterns when we're quiet. We sit with these habit patterns that have gone unchecked. So somebody mentioned, one of you mentioned seeing the habit pattern of fear kind of beneath something else that was normally seen. And so myself too, you know, a lot of times I'm the one confessing up here that I see patterns too that I've never seen before or never seen as deeply. Patterns of fear about the aging, my own aging process. Patterns of, and maybe that just comes with because of the onset of seeing more aging in my body, in my mind. Fear for what can happen around me. You know, things that are scary around me. And just the fact of living this life. And what will happen at the time of death. No, I'm not the only one who thinks this, right? I mean, okay. So all of these patterns that we come to see, I mean, lucky that we can see them. One of my colleagues, Joseph Goldstein, my elder colleague, says it's better to see them than not to see them. I mean, this is so simple, right, and straightforward. But every time he says that when I'm in a retreat with him, and somebody's saying something about their practice, and he says, well, better to see it than not to see it. And I think, I wish I could really know that all the time, you know, because sometimes when the mind opens to something that's really hard to be with, hard to see with, it's like, ooh, I don't want to see that right now, you know. Let's not think about that right now. And so just opening to, it's better to kind of put it out on the table and really pay attention to that. And then it has a chance to do its thing, rather than kind of burying it under a lot of our psychological and whatever habitual rugs until it all gets piled up, and then you have to, maybe it's too late then, you know, maybe we're just about to die and we haven't let that one out yet. Or something else is just about to die, you know, a relationship or something like that. And too much to figure out all at once. So a lot that goes unchecked, or we feel overwhelmed or surprised in how, about how deep and unrelenting the habit patterns are, driving our lives. So to be aware is good. We really need that to support that awareness in our lives. I want to read something from Utejaniya. It is absolutely vital that we recognize the value of awareness itself. We need to value the actual working of being aware. We need to understand that this activity brings results. The moment we become aware, we replace not knowing with knowing. Only when we know can we understand and develop interest in what is happening. Understanding what is happening will bring peace to the mind. Once you understand the preciousness of this process, you will feel joy and be interested in looking deeper and deeper. It's kind of hard to believe that last line, you know, you will feel joy and be interested in looking deeper and deeper. But I've seen those moments. It might not be joy, but it may be a sense of relief that, wow, this can be open to. This can be seen instead of being hidden underneath a lot of delusion or ignorance. Ignorance is just ignoring something, avoiding something. And delusion is seeing something but making something else out of that. It's two different meanings there. Somebody, I wish I could remember his name, but somebody said that delusion is seeing but getting it wrong. And then we act on that part. You know, we're not seeing clearly, and then we act on that. But we're not acting on what's really happening. I've felt a lot of relief from knowing. I would rather know than not know. Even when something is really hard to know, it puts me in a place of really facing it. So I'm good with that. It's hard, but I'm really good with that. Like when I knew when my children were growing up, I would feel that they were doing something that was not quite right, or they were doing something with, you know, not being straight with me. And I would say, I really want to know the truth. What's happening? You know, are you smoking pakalolo again? You know what pakalolo is. are you not being truthful with me about something? Because if I know, then I can just be with it and relax more around the knowing of it. I may have ways of not liking what's happening and maybe ways of reacting, but I can have a check on that. I can deal with that. But it's really hard for me to deal with delusion, much harder to deal with not knowing than it is to deal with aversion and wanting, because not knowing is so hidden. And then we hide it even more by not wanting to know, because it's hard. It's really hard for me to be, you know, this delusion is really deception. We're deceiving ourselves. When I feel that there's deception around me, it's like, come on, lay this stuff on the table. I really want to face it, instead of really not facing it. So once you understand the preciousness of this process, you will feel joy and be interested in looking deeper and deeper. And so I have felt in my life opening to something and really being pleased, maybe not like smiling, happy, laughing, joyful, but being pleased that I could see what was going on. There could be sometimes moments of delight to see the aversion in the mind. So that happens because we understand the strength of awareness and the support that compassion can give to be able to come close to it. So in our practice here, we learn that we can no longer fool ourselves. We learn to be really honest in facing what is difficult, and touch and open to the parts we're not proud of. To be able to acknowledge shame or prejudice or self-loathing, unworthiness, disdain for others who aren't really like us, but they're just innocently living out their own lives. But we kind of have this feeling towards them that actually doesn't make sense at all. It comes from really deep unseen habit patterns. And so, of course, there are those things, but there are the beautiful, beneficent qualities too. For the most part, they're easy to be with. Gratitude, forgiveness, attitudes of generosity and friendliness. But it takes a fair amount of compassion to open to the ones that are really hard. When we feel hatred or disdain, when there's dismissiveness in our own minds, attachment to our viewpoint of how we think things should be in here or out there, fear. So in our rational minds, we know that these patterns related to greed, hatred, and delusion are harmful, and they're so deeply rooted. And they're so ingrained and entrenched sometimes that it's hard to... We keep falling into them. One yogi a long time ago, when I first started teaching in the 90s, she said, oh, she saw them as cow paths of her mind. You know, I live around a lot of where there are cattle ranches, and sometimes I walk in the fields there when I know there's no bulls in that in that particular area. And you know how the cattle walk, it's amazing, you know, they've got these four legs like this on each side, but they walk like in this, they create kind of like a trench that you can't even see sometimes. And you're walking along and you just fall into this deep place. It's not like a wide path, it's like this small little, the path maybe where they go from one place to meet the cowboy at the top of the hill. So I see that happen in my own practice. Sometimes I just don't even see it coming and fall into a trench in the mind. Kind of like as a habit, don't see it. Habits that cause harm. And we know they cause harm, but we're not able to really face it sometimes. We open to something and say, we want to get out of there right away so fast that we don't even take time to kind of recognize and relax, to be open to it in a way that we need to bring compassion to it, to be open to it, and to see it as, okay, this is a natural occurrence. So that's why we're in this training together. And from what I hear and see in the various communities I'm connected with and feel in my own heart this way too, there's a growing sense of urgency to help and to do what we can to offer our gifts, however insignificant we consider them, to do what we can to offer, to touch the world with this increasing speed and complexity, to touch it with slowing down, with kindness, with simplicity. And when we have this growing sense of urgency, that too is coming from compassion. Equally as strong, there is a growing urgency to go within, to really deep within, to know ourselves completely. I forget the woman many centuries ago. It's a picture I get of this woman sitting under a tree, knowing oneself completely. No part left out. I mean, that's in my own posture of sitting, that's the way I feel like. May every part be known. May no part be hidden. And may it come up at the right time. Like, sometimes it's so hard. But whenever it comes up, that landscape, that inner landscape needs to be known. So that if it's unwholesome, we can refrain. And if it's wholesome, we can proceed and we can nurture that place. In the course of all that, there's a purification process taking place. The process of allowing what is to be known to come up, and when an unwholesome state of mind arises, it's like its roots are a little bit loosened from that soil of the personality, the soil of the deep habit patterns of the mind. When it's allowed to come up, it's sort of loosened a bit, and it's weakened. Every time awareness is brought to an unwholesome state of mind, it is weakened. But in the reverse, actually, you might not realize it, that every time a wholesome state of mind awareness is brought to that, it is nurtured. It's actually strengthened. So we're seeing with sobering honesty now what's happening. This comes from Agnes Au, an article about Buddhist women of color. And she talks about exposing and unlayering the painful habit patterns. I love the way she says this. I see this path is actually an invitation to strip naked at one's own pace, and in so doing to experience the vividness of an unfiltered life. the vividness of an unfiltered life because we're not filtering it through greed, hatred, and delusion. And if greed, hatred, and delusion comes up, we're not filtering it through another layer of delusion and ignorance. You know, we're not avoiding it, nor are we seeing it in a way that, you know, makes us say, oh, that's all right, that can be there. And, you know, we don't try to do anything about it, like let it fully be seen, bring compassion to it, let it loosen its roots. So this process that we're in, we're discovering the habitual forces of the mind and the heart that keep making up this inner terrain, this sense of self that we keep wrapping kind of a solidity around. And then it has an effect on the outer world, on this world we live in. And so we as we know ourselves more, we see what creates harmony and happiness on the individual level and on the level of the social level. And we intentionally bring more energy to that. But when we see that the mind is inclining towards the habitual forces that create unrest or distress or disharmony, fear, on the level of our own hearts, and then of course we act it out in the world, we try to bring a sense of restraint to that. Why? It's so simple. It's because it's seen clearly. But a lot of times, you know, we don't have the habit of seeing clearly. So we start to have this urgency to let go, to weaken those habit patterns, and to incline the mind towards bringing those wholesome states of mind into play more, like compassion. So His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, one of his beautiful sayings is, until you understand the meaning of suffering, there will still be a measure of hypocrisy to your life, to the way you bring compassion to your life too. So when you take a simple look at how the Buddha's teachings are laid out, it's developing and nurturing what creates harmony and goodwill. There's three things only. Developing and nurturing what creates harmony and goodwill. Two is disarming what is harmful in our hearts and in our minds. And number three is from this, developing liberating wisdom. Because it's only when these two things are laid down as a foundation that the ability for liberating wisdom to arise can happen. Because we're seeing clearly, compassionately. So with these two wings of the Dharma, we're able to face the vulnerabilities of this world and then take clear and appropriate action when it's needed. Without the strength, we're not able to do anything that's really wise, that's really helpful and compassionate outwardly in the world. So we're talking about the ecology of compassion, so I want to give kind of a description about a little more of the terrain that we can come across when we're practicing compassion. There are these things called the near enemy and the far enemy of compassion. The near enemy is called grief, or that kind of grief that's unhealthy, that overwhelming grief. Sometimes it's a kind of grief for the world or grief for somebody who is in suffering. And sometimes that's translated as pity. And it's like drowning in it. It's not a feeling of, you know, this healthy grief when there's a death or a loss, that one goes through this grieving process. It's really healthy being able to face the loss within oneself. But it's an overwhelming grief where you feel like you're drowning in it. Or pity for oneself, pity for another. It's not that kind of pity which says, oh, I'm better than you. I mean, there's that kind too. So, yeah, I feel sorry for you. That sometimes people call that pity also. But this is a kind of pity where you're so lost in the suffering that you can't help yourself or you can't help another person. And in the ancient scriptures, there's a story of how somebody falls into quicksand, for example, and it's pulling the person down and down and down. And so when one can't see it, we feel so overwhelmingly sorry for that person. We jump in to try to help that person, but we ourselves also get pulled down. So this is why it's important to see when that's coming up, this kind of overwhelming grief, that we don't jump in to help, but we do what we can to help from a place of strength. So metaphorically, that might mean that we just stand by the side and find a stick that can really reach, you know, something that can reach across, and something that can say, this is sturdy. You hold on to that side, I'll hold on to this side, and let yourself be pulled out of this. And so there's so many ways that you can give analogies there too, but basically it's standing in a place where we feel sturdy and we feel we're in a safe place so that we can help another. So we need both wisdom and compassion to do that. Real compassion, the compassion that's courage. So it allows a clear view of what's really happening so we can be of help. That's the near enemy. It's called the near enemy because sometimes it feels like compassion, but it really isn't. And the far enemy is cruelty. It's called the far enemy because you can see it from afar. It's really distinct. It's not compassion at all. Cruelty pushes away. You know, when somebody's in pain and it's hard, sometimes it is hard and we do have to step away. But stepping away gently is different from pushing away. When we push away, it really hurts our own karmic river because we're putting more unwholesome seeds into that river, which will sprout at some other place. When we push away or we strike out at with our words or with our dismissive behavior, we strike out at that person or even ourselves. When we have difficulties within us arise, we strike out with, you know, I shouldn't feel this way, or I should be better, or I'm ashamed of, you know, all those ways that we strike out at ourselves. Attitudes of anger and ill will, retaliation, passive aggressiveness, you know. And there's ignorance, like, you know, that's a cruelty too, like, no, just going to ignore your suffering because it doesn't have anything to do with me. It's your problem, not mine. So when these arise and awareness is brought to them, then wisdom also can be brought into that place. But if there's no awareness, there's no wisdom because we're just not seeing it. One of the proximate causes for wisdom to arise is awareness. So when these arise, it depletes our energy, you know, the far enemy, the near enemy. We have little left to help ourselves or to others. And we keep doing the same thing. So it's really hard to stop that from happening again and again and again because we keep planting more seeds of that in our karmic stream. Sometimes when I've been the target of it, it's the hardest thing to have compassion for me towards people who are acting in this way where they're not really understanding the karmic principles of harming and non-harming. And it's hardest for me to bring compassion to delusion. Somehow it's easier when there's, you know, aversion, then you can say, oh, sometimes you just say, oh, they're just having a hard day. Or you might not say it with so much, you know, compassion. But there can be excuses for that. But delusion, I mean, when somebody can't even open to understanding that you're bringing just harm, more harm to yourself by replanting that in your own mind over and over again. So it's interesting to watch the ways where we can be strong with our compassion and wisdom. And some words about how compassion that's fierce is not necessarily filled with hatred or cruelty. Sometimes compassion can be very fierce. In the Tibetan tradition, I'm not so studied in this, but there are compassionate deities that have swords, you know, just cutting out what is not right, what causes harm. There can be the fierceness of no without the aversion, without the hatred of no. Martin Luther King Jr., I'm paraphrasing him, said very clearly, no to violence, no to inequality, no to racism, no to discrimination of any kind, gender, creed, color, or spiritual beliefs. This no is not out of hatred, but out of respect and compassion for all. So fierceness can come from compassion. So we have to be careful what discernment we're making out of that no. And there's this no that one of my friends, she's a translator for Tibetans, we both take on more than we can handle. So one time she was giving me a little admonition and she said, Kamala, remember, no is a complete sentence. You don't have to explain why, you can just say no. And so, you know, that's out of compassion for yourself. That doesn't have to be out of, like, anger. So, granted, with our practice, we may not radically change the whole world, but in fact, we may transform our own hearts. And from there, we can send out ripples into the world with our, you know, actions and our thoughts and our deeds and our words here and there that bring harmony to the world instead of the opposite, instead of harm. So His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, compassion doesn't make atrocities of the world disappear or see them as right. It just stops these atrocities from continuing right here in our own hearts. And that's a place that we have, if we have any control, that's the place that we have most of the influence to stop the atrocities and to develop the opposite of that, the places that can bring harmony. So there's something really precious and rare about learning to be with the truth of life, with the balance of compassion and wisdom. There's a dignity, a grace, an acceptance of who we are in completeness with all of that. And this compassion and wisdom, the two wings of the Dharma, will really allow us to really fly to freedom. So I say bring a lot of poems to my practice and to my own teaching, because I think poems say in words that we know of in our kind of present language can go into our hearts a little more. So this really famous poem comes from a tea box of celestial seasonings. And it's from the Findhorn Garden. And I think of this a lot. I remember this a lot. Flowers unfold slowly and gently, bit by bit, in the sunshine. And a heart, too, must never be pushed or driven, but unfold in its own perfect timing to reveal its true wonder and beauty. So bringing compassion and wisdom into our lives.